Tom Woods Show, episode 2307.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're like me, when you criticize the Federal Reserve, you get all these lackey-style responses. Why, the Fed has made the economy more stable. You don't want to go back to the 19th century, do you? All kinds of arguments like that. Well, you can blow those and others out of the water with my free ebook, Our Enemy, the Fed. Grab it at ourenemythefed.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am talking about a topic we covered a bit in the relatively recent past, but there's so much more to say about it. And it's important to get a grasp of this material because this kind of issue is not going away. And every time it comes up, there are people who have their own agenda who want to exploit it. And of course, I'm talking about bank failures, specifically the Silicon Valley Bank, but not limited to that. And I want to spend a little time here, and probably a good bulk of the time, talking about the reality of the regulatory apparatus under which these various institutions operate. Because most people calling for, quote, more regulation don't know a single thing about it. And I'm talking to somebody who has an awful lot of experience with bank regulation, and that is Kevin Johnston. Kevin, given that you have rather an interesting background, let's say, I'm going to actually give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to the audience.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, Tom. So my name's Kevin Johnston, and I am the chief operating officer for a very small bank, one of the smallest in the country, out of Bellevue, Washington. And we basically purchased the bank in 2019, and I thought it'd be relatively interesting for you to have somebody behind enemy lines on your podcast.
And so I do. And as a matter of fact, you sent me an email. I said, well, why don't you give me a few bullet points about if you were to come on, what we were to talk about? Oh my gosh, I got way more than I bargained for here. I want to publish your quote unquote bullet points as an ebook or something. So let's dig into them. First of all, is there something you can say about quote unquote Dodd-Frank? Because I've had Peter Wallison on here, and he's written a whole book on the problems with Dodd-Frank, and he was convinced that Dodd-Frank was disproportionately hurting smaller banks, that the number of smaller banks was stagnating, that this is where a lot of businesses locally will get credit from, and so it's going to harm them. Anything that harms small banks is going to harm them. But yet, on the other hand, we've been told that an alleged gutting of Dodd-Frank by Donald Trump is what made the SVB fiasco possible. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a couple angles on that matter that really pertain to what we do every day and what the threats are that we see on a competitive landscape. Because the fact of the matter is those regulations are written by big banks, and it makes it a lot easier for them to merge, acquire, and basically get rid of the competition in the small banking space. I don't know if you recall, but there was a study in 2018 regarding the net increase or decrease of startups, I guess. And the fact of the matter is 2018 was the first year in American history that they had measured that small businesses were starting to go away. I think that has something to do with the small banks going away, because small banks are kind of the banks that try to make a transaction work. We're trying to figure out a way, how do we finance the small mom and pop shops, the small real estate investors? Commercial lending is really done by the small institutions. And so as these banks go away, which, as you know, there were 12,000 banks in the United States prior to Dodd-Frank, but also prior to 2008. And now there's 5,000 and it's quickly going down. So there's some serious challenges there. And what I would like to say to your audience is that we all want the banking system to look a lot differently than it is. I am very much in your camp of understanding of economics generally and banking in particular. But where we are today, what is the best way in this economy for it to all work? And the answer is, we want the system to be as robust as possible based on the fact that small banks are servicing people that do not always fit inside a box. They're not always easy to underwrite or understand. And there's also the cultural issues, obviously, that are going on, which we can get into as well.
Okay, a lot to follow up on here. So why don't we, even though this, obviously, this issue of bank regulation and the system we have goes well beyond the case of any one bank, we have been hearing quite a bit about particular banks. So Silicon Valley Bank, we talked a bit about on the show. And then I had a guy named Kevin Duffy at, I can't remember his institutional affiliation, but Kevin Duffy wrote to say that actually Silicon Valley Bank did not have to be subject to the so-called stress tests of Dodd-Frank because of the quote-unquote deregulation. But he says, but none of that matters because Silicon Valley Bank would have passed that stress test with flying colors because it was invested in all the safe and right things and they did all the right things that would satisfy a regulator. So even if it had the stupid stress test, wouldn't have helped us any.
Right.
So again, you know, it's like I sometimes think about firearms regulation. There'll be some terrible tragedy that occurs and people will recommend particular firearms regulations, none of which would have solved that problem.
Yes.
If all of those had been in effect at the time, nothing would have been different. This just seems to be a phenomenon across, like a cross-governmental phenomenon that people want to believe that there was one repealed thing that could have fixed this, or there's one simple bit of legislation that would have stopped it. And I think it's just trickier than that.
Right. Okay. So yeah, exactly. And thanks for drawing me back to kind of the whole point, which is this, is that you have 15 angles in which these banks are being pushed into what they're doing. One of which is really, you know, if you're talking about some of these big failures lately, a couple of things have driven what's gone on there that are important for people to know. When I'm listening to all these different podcasts and kind of postmortems of these different banks, the problem is that everybody's talking about how incompetent, how woke, how culturally in disarray, and really how the expertise was not there in a lot of these big banks. And that's fine. That's very much as true as far as it goes. But the fact of the matter is, as you know, that a fractional reserve bank, deposits are the fuel. They're the fuel for how the engine runs. And basically, you're lending on deposits. We all know what the dangers of that are and what the implications of that are. But the fact is that when you have big growth in deposits at a bank, no matter what your size is, the big banks obviously can't grow to a percentage that endangers them. But at a regional or small bank, if your deposits grow substantially, you are generally urged to put those into certain buckets. We've got mortgage-backed securities, bonds, treasuries. And the fact is, when rates start to go up very substantially, the mark-to-market accounting on those types of assets means that if there's any danger in the deposit base, you will see a capital issue occur. So let me walk through that a little more step-by-step here. Specifically to the large deposit growth piece, crypto deposits have been recommended by the regulators to not be lent upon really in any circumstances at this point. That means, what do you do with the deposits that come in from a crypto type entity? Well, you have your shareholders to report to. So you cannot just sit on those because they cost money for you to be monitoring and for you to be paying interest on any deposits. And so let me step way back, please, if you don't mind, just because I'm kind of getting lost in the weeds real quick. So let's do this. I want to lay this out in a sequential understanding so that it's very clear why we are led basically down one path for these big banks. So specifically on the matter of crypto, as you know, deposits are the fuel for lending at a fractional reserve bank. The regulators have really officially and unofficially over the last few years told banks, you may not lend on crypto deposits. And that's probably a wise decision because these are volatile deposits that can really leave at any time. If a crypto fund or a crypto investor needs their cash, that money is going away. And so that deposit goes away. And so if you lend on that, you end up having a run on the bank in some sense, or you end up with a liquidity issue. So sometimes banks don't really have a choice but not to lend certain deposits. And that's obviously the case in crypto because they've been told not to, but it can also be the case when they have grown too quickly. So of course, the government is going to also want, at the same time, different branch of the government, of course, in some sense, but they want as many buyers of government debt and GSE assets as is possible. GSEs being the government-sponsored entities, Fannie and Freddie, right? So one quote-unquote super safe investment that banks are encouraged to use are treasuries and mortgage-backed securities when they can't loan those deposits out. And the result is that you've got a few specialized, highly growing financial institutions in this space who are not entirely educated enough to be hedging the correct way when they're putting money from crypto or high growth deposits into these financial instruments on a long-term basis or even a structured ladder. So we all know over the long term that interest rates were going to go up, but that means that those instruments go down in value as the interest rates go up. And so when you have a mark-to-market accounting function, that means you have to discount against your capital base. And some banks have so many of those instruments because they can't loan the money out quickly enough on the credit side. So they just, again, all you do is put it into an overnight treasury or a mortgage-backed security. There's almost no choice there because your investors are requiring you to have a certain return and deposits cost money, but you end up putting them into something that's going to lose value. And the regulators have told you is a safe asset class, right? And so, yes, you have an issue here. It's the woke executive's fault, sure. But even if they didn't hedge, they would have been fine without the panic because those bonds, of course, pay out at the end of their maturity in full. So that's kind of the first major hurdle of what happened in these institutions is that we were told, all bankers are told, this is the safest asset class that you can be in, which is bonds, treasury bonds, mortgage-backed securities. And the regulators have told banks over and over again, you cannot get hurt if you're managing this stuff correctly. And granted, there is that mismanagement, but you know, this is a challenge here.
Can you talk to me about the Community Reinvestment Act? Because I talked a little bit about this in one of my books, but even I didn't think it played that big of a role. I thought it was being exaggerated because the conservative movement didn't know what to say. They had to find something. They're definitely not going to talk about the Fed. So in 2008, they talked about this.
Right.
But you're saying that it may in fact be a problem.
Yeah, I think it's a massive problem. And it's like one of these dinosaur regulation that is going to end up kind of coming back with a vengeance. These regulations were written for a geographical world that is not really digitized. And so it makes a lot less sense now than it might have at one point. You know, it's great to have the intent of non-discrimination, whatever that whole goal of the CRA was, but now it's morphed into something entirely different. So this issue that I just discussed about mark-to-market accounting and how these bonds decrease in value really pertains mostly to small institutions. And I remember a couple months ago reading that there were, say, 50 banks that were susceptible to these valuation issues that really are looming over the capital and liquidity of all these banks. And then it became, you know, 120. And then I think there's something like 280 to 300 banks that have this issue now. I would guess most of those are small banks. Why? Because of the Community Reinvestment Act. So to comply with the Community Reinvestment Act, there is a 5-prong test for small banks. And two of the prongs for some of these small rural banks really are diametrically opposed to each other. The first says you want to lend out as much of your deposits as you can in your local community. And then the second prong, you know, which is, again, these are not truly sequential, but of the importance of these five, is that you need to be lending out over 50% in your local area. So it's kind of like lend as much as you can, but also 50% needs to be in your area, 50% or more. A lot of small banks cannot lend 50% in their area. They're in small rural farming towns. And so they just stop lending. And they could buy a pool of loans, maybe, but there's really all sorts of different credit issues that they might run into if they just buy some random pool of loans from across the country or whatever. So you can guess what they do. They buy bonds. And so, as Scott Horton says, it's a self-licking ice cream cone, right? Where the government basically prohibits certain activities or at least directs banks away from them. And then the default option becomes purchasing their debt and then the associated issues that come with that when rates go up. You have this mark-to-market issue. And there's zero sympathy to fix this problem by the public in banking, this problem being the Community Reinvestment Act. And mostly that's rightfully, people don't like the banks, and that's understandable. But then you've got the big banks who wrote this legislation and who really would like to see these small banks go away. And so there's no interest there in fixing it either. And so it's kind of a catch-22 where we're all stuck and the big banks are just going to keep getting bigger and causing all the cultural issues we're seeing today.
You even push back a little bit against the, oh, these bank executives are terrible people and making bad decisions argument, which in many cases they are, and they are making bad decisions. But you have a very, very interesting comment that I'd like you to elaborate on where you say, there is some of that, sure, But you also have a regulatory regime, which is literally impossible to understand in its entire scope by anyone, as well as pressure by the regulatory bodies to do things which are not sound banking practices, and an increase in capriciousness and arbitrariness in laws like UDAAP, which give the regulatory agencies much more power than they have ever had before. I would venture to guess that most people listening to this have never really had to reckon with the web of banking regulations that exist, but you have. So what light can you shed on it from somebody who's had a firsthand exposure to it?
Well, first of all, it is a morass. The scope is completely impossible for really even any team. You need an economy of scale, right? So that's why these big banks have such an advantage. As far as arbitrary and capricious, you can see that very clearly and much more clearly than any specific regulation and how this whole systemically important institution discussion is being carried out in the mainstream media and in the financial news. The fact is this is decided, it seems, after the fact. It's not really a matter that's decided by a vote at the Federal Reserve. And as we all know, the ownership of the Federal Reserve is relatively private, but it's private in two ways, right? I mean, it's owned by other banks, presumably, and that is, as far as percentages go, as far as exact ownership goes, it's not known to the public. And so it's very hard to figure out, okay, well, who is pulling the strings here behind the closed doors of what the Federal Reserve is doing and how it's making these decisions about systemic importance? So there's an arbitrary and capricious aspect to the entire venture with respect to that question. But, you know, in addition to that, there are laws like UDAAP, it's actually called UDAP in the industry lingo. And UDAP is unfair deceptive practices. And so the UDAP laws, they provide a lot of latitude in the fact that there's not always intent in these laws. Instead, what you have is the ability of the regulators to say, this looks unfair or deceptive, and therefore it is. And you are fined or whatever.
Now, you mentioned the Fed, but what role does the Fed play? Is it an indirect role? Is it a background role? Is it a central role in accounting for a case like SVB? Or if now we're hearing these, as you say, stories that maybe dozens of institutions are a little bit shaky, how does the Fed have a hand in that? If it were entirely the Fed, then every bank would be in major trouble, and yet they're not. So how do we comment on the relationship of the Fed to all this?
You know, the Fed is really the super supervisor, right? So you've got really dozens of other regulators, but the primary ones are the OCC, which is regulating the national banks, and then the FDIC, which is really kind of overseeing all of the state charters. And then you have the individual state departments of financial institutions and commerce, et cetera. Each of these different layers have a different say over how a bank is regulated and is interacting with us, you know, really as exams come up or as an issue, you know, a complaint comes in, et cetera. And so the Federal Reserve, really, we don't see a lot of the Federal Reserve other than in its financial implications in the market. The regulations are really driven by the FDIC and those different state bodies and the OCC in particular. The fact is the Federal Reserve is obviously the lender of last resort and the backstop for the FDIC fund, which is the insurance fund protecting deposits from a run, which is generally, as everyone will admit to you, if they've studied the issue long enough, a psychological phenomenon rather than a true financial backstop if there was an issue. But that said, you know, it's kind of like insurance in general is a psychological phenomenon. Generally, everything's not going to go poorly all at once everywhere in insurance. And so if you have a concentration of insurance in a particular area, it's not necessarily the case that you need every building to be perfectly insured in order to make insurance a sound work, I guess.
I'm sorry, this one is kind of turning into, then I want to ask you this, then I want to ask you this, then I want to, instead of just a straight conversation, but there are so many things I want to hit on. So I hadn't heard about this till I heard from you. And again, if you're not actively in the financial world, I don't think you would know about these things. But for instance, I didn't know about the quote, allowance for loan losses, and what that has to do with the IRS and how that affects the way institutions behave. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is one that actually I figured out and asked one of my accounting peers at one point early in my banking career. So first of all, let's start back at the beginning, right? So again, what a bank is doing is it is taking deposits and is lending a certain percentage of those out to certain individuals. And then with that, you are going to create credit risk because there's always the case that someone will not pay you back. And so you take collateral as a backstop against a loss there. Well, if you have not underwritten a loan correctly, and that collateral, you seize the collateral or whatever the case may be, you end up having to write that down against your capital if there's a loss. Well, before you get to capital, though, there's something called an allowance for loan losses. Well, it's actually an ALL, allowance for leases and loan losses. And generally, an allowance is 1% of bank assets. And so again, this is kind of an insurance interior to the bank against credit losses. And when you have a loan go bad, and if there's a shortfall, it comes out of your ALL. So again, it's around 1% of the bank's assets. Well, if it's too large, this is kind of a weird thing about it, is that if it's too large during your regular bank exam, or if the IRS audits you, you're going to be required to take money out of that bucket so the IRS can get their cut. So in other words, they think that you're kind of padding the nest a little bit much. And they say, well, you have 2% instead of 1% in your allowance. And so you need to basically divest that out of your allowance so that you have to pay taxes on that as earnings, right? So that means that banks really, as they cede ground, as they get more conservative because these laws and regs really push them into certain areas of lending and away from others, they end up unable or unwilling to take risks over a certain threshold. And really, that threshold is one of historical perception. You know, it's based on the fact that they've seen losses in this certain area or they understand what this credit risk is. Why? Because they can't beef up that reserve. But think about the fact that all these banks that want to grow their deposits rapidly, they might have alternatively bought some kind of short-term auto paper pool or some kind of credit that had a short fuse on it instead of mortgage-backed securities, instead of treasuries, so that this very obvious risk profile from the safest investment on the planet, that is treasuries and MBS, mortgage-backed securities, that would be an alternative. But if you did that and you didn't trust the seller of this loan package or this agency that rated it, then maybe you don't even know the asset class in particular, then you cannot go and say, you know what, let's take our ALL, let's beef it up to 5% instead of 1% of our assets so that we can endure some losses here and we're still totally safe as an institution. You're not allowed to do that. They won't let you do that. And so you're boxed in. And why on earth would we not allow banks to have a risk insurance pool as big as they like? Well, because of taxes, because the tax man wants his cut. And you want less credit problems in the economy. Well, that's a tension between banking and the IRS. And that's something not a lot of bankers realize is the case. But part of why you see banks in trouble on occasion is because they are not able to reserve enough. And it begins to eat into capital once you burn through your ALL, which is a huge no-no. I mean, that's when they start to talk about closing your bank down.
I think it was when I had Peter St. Ange on. I think I was trying to ask, chances are we're not going to see the kind of banking reform that you and I might want. So is there a second best? Is there, not that it's ideal, not that it would necessarily last for 500 years, but is there a set of changes that is, even if only remotely, plausible that would at least be moving us in the right direction? Can you think of anything?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I think the credit unions are eating the bank's lunch just in general, because they don't pay taxes. And good on anybody for not paying taxes. But man, I do hate it when my competitors still have to pay it. You know, so that's the first thing. But also, I think the fintech piece, I think really banks pivoting toward doing more interesting stuff is very important with technological needs. And so there's a lot of banks. I think banks are going to continue to die. The regulators have expressed that they want there to be a lot less institutions. I believe they want there to be, I read somewhere 2,500 was kind of what they wanted. And so that means that this is halfway intended. But that's part of the problem is, again, we want a diverse offering from institutions regarding credit, regarding deposits, regarding financial technology, and really regarding culture. And I think that's a piece I'd love to kind of get into a little bit. and this is really just a pitch, I really just want to say that we are a very small institution. And something that's interesting about us is that basically four of us in 2019 bought one of the smallest bank charters in the country, tiny little town in Minnesota. We renamed it, rebranded it, repaired and enhanced the rails, wanted to build something more sleek and effective than most community banks that are out there, which are kind of doing nothing. And Warren Buffett talks about building moat around your business. And banks have a natural moat because the time and cost of acquisition and the difficulty of compliance, which is like just growing like crazy every year, makes it very difficult for people just get into this type of investment or industry. So we, as a small bank, again, called Portage Bank, we want to do interesting things. We want to make decisions quickly. We want our executives to be able to talk to people. And we're really trying to be an alternative outlet for people seeking refuge from big banks and cancel culture. We want to be easy to work with and really offer anything you can get at a big institution. But what I want to do is I want to be in the background, being compliant and running the thing carefully so you can know that your financial access is safe. And some of the worst people on the planet, whether you're government arms dealers, Jeffrey Epstein's, have bank accounts. And I think personally, it's absurd. And as does our executive team, our owners, our board, that the beliefs of half the country's population have put them at risk of losing access to the financial system. Things that were perfectly acceptable opinions 5 minutes ago and are a good deal less bad than running a pornography production or, again, being an arms dealer or whatever. All of these people that we don't like in the world, that we have our moral standards about, have bank accounts. People that are much, much worse than those who don't like the latest style or whatever that is. So really, it's very frustrating to watch banks as an industry be closed off to customers just for their political beliefs or cultural understanding.
How do people get in touch with you?
Yeah, I would just email. I have a mass email box that COO, like Chief Operating Officer at Portage.bank. That's a .bank, not .com. And I'd be glad to hear from whoever. Yeah.
And then is the website what I would see from the email address?
It is. Yeah. Portage.bank. Yeah.
Portage.bank. All right. So I'll put that up. But then also, as long as you feel like you've said your piece and we can transition a bit, I know you wanted to take a few minutes to talk about the community that you either live in or are building or both right now.
Yeah, I think I'd just make a quick 15-second pitch. My wife and I and our three kids and one on the way have recently moved to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho from Seattle, which is just getting really decrepit and they're watching it decline and it almost seems purposeful. So we had to kind of get out. And 6 months ago, we moved over here. It's a small resort town with really good school options. We are very Catholic. There are masses here ranging from kind of post-Vatican II, boomer, whatever, to traditional Latin mass and even SSPX. There's a lot of Catholics in their 20s and 30s moving here with their families to make sure that their kids are not sacrificed to the culture. And we really want to build a culture here that's thoughtful about the faith without being kind of a weird and culty little insular group. So far, it's been really a dream come true and really a harbor like you wouldn't believe. It's very hard to find libertarians. Everybody's kind of just conservative, which is fine. It has its place, especially right now. But if you're Catholic, if you're interested in kind of that culture building piece, please reach out to me in that context as well. I'd love to hear from you.
All right. So I'll have your email address and the website for the bank, portage.bank, up at tomwoods.com/2307. Well, that was quite a lot of information packed into a small amount of time, but it's information we needed very much and just sheds further light on the situation that we're in and the real reasons that we got there. So, Kevin, thanks so much for that. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.